This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. With each new headline announcing an outbreak of a disease, the public frantically looks to protect itself with the latest vaccines, and medical researchers rush to deliver something that is both safe and effective. But is it inclusive? Vaccines and other medications are rarely tested on pregnant women, even when the disease being targeted affects unborn children, diseases like rubella and Zika. Leslie Regan is a professor of history and gender and women's studies at the University of Illinois. She wrote a book about the rubella epidemic of the 1960s and the resulting medical discoveries and dilemmas, and she joins us now. Welcome, Leslie.
Hi. Good to talk to you today.
Good to talk with you. And Ann Lyerly is here. She's a physician and a professor of social medicine at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, also associate director of the Center for Bioethics. Annie, welcome. Good to have you here as well.
Delighted to be here.
There are some legitimate concerns involving pregnant women, but you say that we should really probably spend more time and attention and think about including pregnant women in some of this kind of research. Tell us more.
Absolutely. Pregnant women have traditionally been excluded from most biomedical research. And the notion has been, if we don't know whether something is safe or effective in a pregnant woman, how could we possibly ethically test it in her? But the result is that when pregnant women get sick or women who have illnesses get pregnant, there's no data to guide the dosing or safety concerns and decisions about whether they should use medication.
I'm assuming, though, that there's some very good reasons for not including pregnant women in those studies because they haven't quite properly been tested yet. And so tell us about the ethical guidelines and why you think those guidelines are in place right now.
Well, currently, the formal guidelines allow research with pregnant women, but there are a lot of concerns about moving forward with such research. Of course, one of the strongest animating concerns is that there is a fetus involved. The fetus can't consent for itself, and it is physiologically vulnerable, if you will. We know that a developing fetus can be harmed by medications. We also know that the developing fetus can be harmed by maternal illness, and so treating illness is important in pregnancy.
And and we talk about a developing fetus, and of course that's not a fully formed human being in the sense that it is still developing all of its parts, and therefore a different kind of if you want to look at it as a test subject. So it's hard for science to know exactly what effect it's going to have on that when it's all of the lab testing has been for a fully developed human being, right? I mean, that's part of the question.
That is part of the question. I mean, of course, there are tests that can be done on animals that give you some information, but it's quite imperfect.
Well, Leslie, let's talk about this because this had important implications for the subject of your book, the rubella outbreak and attempts to develop a vaccine for rubella. Tell us that story.
This is a very interesting issue that Ann Lyerly is pointing to, that the end result of the vaccine is that we don't know in the cases where women get vaccinated now who are pregnant with rubella. The rubella vaccine was developed because German measles caused serious birth defects, and at the time in the 1960s epidemic, there were predictions of 20,000, quote, damaged and deformed babies being born. And there was a lot of anxiety and concern about this. And this was a totally minor disease that no one had been concerned about at all. It didn't hurt anybody. And it wasn't until the 1940s that they knew that it caused deafness, blindness, intellectual disabilities, mental retardation, as they called it then. Mm. And the image that people had in their minds were of thalidomide, of the babies that had been born without arms and legs. And so there was a lot of terror of having babies that looked like that. Abortion was illegal, and that's what people turned to and wanted immediately when they really feared giving birth to these babies. But there was no test. There was no way to know whether they had it. And German measles was just this mild rash, and a lot of people didn't even know they'd had it, which is much like Zika. So this is why they get compared a lot, is they're very similar in a very mild rash. So doctors immediately hoped that a vaccine could be developed to solve the problem of births of disabled children, and also the problem of abortion that everybody wanted to avoid because of its illegality and of the moral issues. So it's kind of this magical solution, I call it. It was of avoiding the social issues and of the fear of disabled children.
So you could develop a vaccine and perhaps prevent German measles or rubella that would cause these other birth defects. The problem is they didn't test it on pregnant women. And so then there's a warning that comes out with the vaccine.
Yes.
And that causes its own set of problems. So tell us what happens next.
Well, and one of the reasons, I mean, Dr. Lyerly knows much more about what happens next, because I actually hadn't thought about that part. But one of the reasons they avoided testing with, or, you know, using the vaccine with potentially pregnant women or pregnant women was, I mean, there were a lot of reasons, but they were concerned, of course, that they would infect the developing fetus, and concerned that if there were any babies who were born with birth defects, that the vaccine would then be blamed and then people wouldn't use it. And they didn't want that to happen. So that's a sort of skeptical view. But the other thing is they believed that the major source of German measles was children, that they were the cause of the epidemic, and the place where you would be infected was among young children. So they targeted children as the cause of the epidemic, and they believed that herd immunity would protect older girls and women. And they also did not have enough vaccine when they initially began the vaccination program, and they didn't have enough money to do the vaccination program in the U.S. So that takes us into the structure of public health and healthcare, which is a situation we'd be talking about today as well.
Well, tell us more about the impact then of rubella once we developed the vaccine, but hadn't tested it on pregnant women.
Right. So as Leslie mentioned, the U.S. strategy was to vaccinate preschool and elementary school aged children, effectively to vaccinate around pregnant women and women of childbearing potential, and protect them in that way. And so one of the things that I thought was extremely interesting is that the rubella story is usually heralded as a success story with regard to public health interventions. But it turns out that the first 10 years don't really comport with that assessment. So after about 10 years with the strategy of vaccinating around women of childbearing potential and pregnant women, although the rates of rubella had dropped significantly, they had not dropped and looked like they were going up in the childbearing age population, and rates of congenital rubella syndrome had not gone down. And so because of that, the Centers for Disease Control decided that they needed to change strategy and move toward vaccinating the individuals who were most at risk, which were individuals of childbearing age. They did not include pregnant women in that context due to what are enduring theoretical concerns that the vaccine could cause rubella, the vaccine itself could cause rubella. But based on these theoretical concerns, they only allowed women of childbearing age and others of childbearing age. And after that, the rates of rubella dropped, and it has been essentially eradicated in the Americas since about 1985. But the point is that the caution around exposing individuals of childbearing age or pregnancy potential to vaccine meant that many women who were pregnant were exposed to and contracted rubella, and many babies were reborn with rubella because of the refusal to vaccinate that population, or the decision not to.
And it seems to me you've really isolated two separate issues here. One is, a policy decision and a change. Okay, we're going to stay away from women of childbearing age because of the risk that they might become pregnant. Then, oh, it's not working because they're precisely who we should vaccinate, so we do. But you're still not testing the drug on pregnant women, and therefore we don't. So you're actually asking the population at large to be your test subjects once the product is on the market and not before.
Exactly. So, you know, what happened in this context was that when women of childbearing age were vaccinated and then became pregnant shortly after, there wasn't information that could tell them about the safety or lack of safety in a conclusive way. And so many of those women terminated their pregnancies because of the uncertainties that were entailed. Upwards 40 to 50% are the, you know, baseline estimates of that. And it wasn't until the early 1990s when data had accumulated to say that rubella vaccine does not cause congenital rubella syndrome and should not be a reason to terminate a pregnancy. In the early 90s, the CDC offered that guidance. But unfortunately, you know, the notion that you should not use a live vaccine in a pregnant woman was entrenched. It was, I was told that when I was training in obstetrics, and live rubella vaccine remains contraindicated in pregnancy. And so pregnant women get caught between these two sets of advice. One that says, oh, if you are vaccinated unintentionally during pregnancy, it's not a reason to terminate your pregnancy. Don't worry. We have some data to say it's not a worry. Oh, but don't do it on purpose.
Right.
And so,
but that's because of the absence of knowledge. So in other words, you will often see the warning on any on a drug that says, you know, pregnant women should avoid or not to be taken by. That's not because, or in many cases, it isn't because it's been tested on pregnant women and shown to be dangerous. It's because it hasn't yet been tested. So we have to warn you. But that comes, that's where you get the sort of mixed advice. Once
Absolutely.
You've done it, oh, relax, don't worry about it.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there's a...
Well, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Let's let Annie finish. Then I want to hear what you have to say.
Yeah,
Lizzie.
Go ahead. Go ahead, Annie.
Well, I was just going to offer an alarming statistic that it takes an average of 27 years from the time a drug is approved for use for healthy populations by the FDA until safety determination in pregnancy is established on average, 27 years. So that gives you a sense of the pace of gathering this research. And we know that about 98% of drugs approved in the last 10 years do not have an adequate safety determination in pregnancy. Doesn't mean that they're not safe. It means that we don't
know. You just don't
know.
Leslie?
Mm. Yeah, that is very alarming. And I was going to say that, you know, there were women of childbearing age getting immunizations for rubella when it came out. They were not pushing it. They were relying on private immunizations by women and doctors. So what they were doing was they were concerned about a public push by the government and private voluntary agencies that were pushing the immunization campaign for German measles, because they would then have to talk about their concerns about pregnancy and urge women to avoid pregnancy. And so this was in 1970, 1969, 1970, and German measles was always directly connected to discussions of abortion at the time. So vaccine was never discussed in terms of abortion, but everybody understood that German measles was related, and they were being talked about together. So this is part of why they were not talking about that. Yeah. They didn't want to have to talk publicly about if you get vaccinated, we don't want you to get pregnant because of these concerns, and that would mean either you don't have sex or you're using the pill at that moment of great controversy and thus instigating, you know, backlash to the U.S. Department of Public Health.
Well,
so that's part of it. And that then got built into the research protocols as well and into the institutional review boards that there will not be research on pregnant women in order – and it's really related to those political movements about – around protecting the fetus and the anti-abortion movement. That's how those got written into federal law.
Yeah, Annie, talk a little bit more about that. I mean, the idea that we do have this separate the separate category for pregnant women, part of it has to do with developing fetus and being a slightly different organism, but a lot of it has to do with who has sovereignty over the unborn child, right?
Well, interestingly, so the regulations governing research in the United States have several parts. There's some that apply to everybody, but there's also a subpart that applies specifically to pregnant women and fetuses. And it articulates a number of layers of requirements, extra requirements that have to be in place if research with pregnant women is going to be conducted, and many of which are reasonable and permissive, some of which are somewhat of a tangle and hard to understand, and some of which I think are problematic. But interestingly enough, when you bring up this notion of sovereignty, it was until just a few months ago that pregnant women were grouped with other categories of research subjects as a vulnerable population.
Yes.
And so
yes.
The other people in those groups were children, mm-hmm. prisoners, individuals with mental disabilities. So, you know, having been pregnant five times myself, I know you get tired when you're pregnant, but you don't lack autonomy or the ability to make decisions about healthcare decisions or bodily integrity or research participation. And so, thankfully, recently, the guidelines have removed that categorization of pregnant women, indicating that while this is potentially complicated research, it's not complicated because pregnant women are unable to provide informed consent.
It's off the books, but I would imagine culturally it's still very much on the minds of those who do this research.
Absolutely. I mean, people talk about vulnerable populations. We're doing a panel on vulnerable populations. Will you participate, Annie? Mm. Sometimes I have to say, yes, but you can't call it that.
Call it that.
Well, I didn't know that had just changed. That's really good. And it's great if you're on the panel so you can re-educate everybody.
But because it has a lot to do with who you're speaking for. The idea is you're not just speaking for yourself. And so the vulnerable, perhaps implicit in that and what's not being spoken, is that this child is not speaking for itself. And this is where some of the complication comes in, Leslie.
Well, it's really a historical change because much of this began with women, pregnant women, women's public health movements speaking and urging efforts on behalf of pregnant women and mothers, where they were seen as the people most responsible for their pregnancies and making decisions for themselves and their children, and were trusted as the ones who could make those decisions. And that was challenged and increasingly changed the 70s and into the 80s.
Right. As the debate over abortion became more separated.
As though women could not be trusted.
Right. Right. I mean,
although the long history has been that if you look at it, they are the ones who, right. you know, then in the past and in the present will go out of their way and jeopardize right. their own health or improve their own health in order to protect their children or the developing child.
I want to thank both of you for being on the program today. Leslie Regan is a professor of history and gender and women's studies at the University of Illinois. Ann Lyerly is a physician and professor of social medicine at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and associate director of UNC's Center for Bioethics. Thank you both for being on the program.
Thank you for having
us.
You can find out more about the work and the research at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, talk about a new podcast, Seeing White, that examines ideas of whiteness and how those ideas influence social behavior and public policy. Stay tuned.